All right, y'all ready to start?
Ready.
All right. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jim Powers.
Hi, Jim. Yeah.
And let's start this meeting with a moment of silent meditation. To be used as you see fit, we'll follow it with the Serenity Prayer. Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. All right. Glad you all are here and have come back. Usually I run them off by this time. Last week, or the last time we were here, we had gotten into more about alcoholism, and we had also talked about a couple of different types of drinkers who could either moderate or stop if they had sufficient reason. The moderate drinker, if the wife, the job, finances, health, or something like that, could stop altogether. The heavy drinker could moderate or stop altogether if they had sufficient reasons. I had sufficient reasons to stop drinking. You know, my ex-wife was going to take my son away and move three states away. That's a pretty good reason to stop drinking. But I wasn't a heavy drinker and I wasn't a moderate drinker. I'm an alcoholic. And so even though I might have great reasons to stop, I couldn't stop. And what Bill's going to do, and like I said before, he continues for the first 60 pages to tell you about the problem and the solution. The problem, step one, the solution, step two, and then how we get there. And so today what we're going to do, at page 32, about halfway down, we're going to go through four different types of alcoholics, and we're going to see how each one of them has a different way of either stopping or actually stopping and then starting again, or doing crazy-ass things. I thought one of the stories in here was just as crazy as could be until I stopped drinking and I started understanding it. And we'll get to that in a minute. But we're going to start with this guy right here. It says, a man of 30, and he's doing a great deal of spree drinking. He's very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieting himself with more liquor. So now he's drinking in the morning, right? He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw that he could get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control whatever. He made up his mind that until he had been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. Now that's pretty cool. I'm gonna maintain my business, so I'm just gonna stop drinking. Boop, stop. An exceptional man, he remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55 after a successful and happy business career. Then he fell victim to the belief which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. All right? He fell victim to that belief which practically every alcoholic has, self-knowledge. Out came his carpet slippers and bottle. In 2 months, he was in a hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital. Meantime, then gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. Every means of solving his problem, which money could buy, was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces quickly and was dead within 4 years. Now, during these four stories, I'm going to bring both my brothers into it. All right. This first one is my older brother. All right. My older brother was a very successful calculus teacher at Winter Park High School, a very prestigious high school in the Orlando area. Somewhere along the line in that teaching, his drinking overtook him. And he was told that he was going to lose his job if he didn't quit drinking. So my brother quit drinking. And he stopped drinking until he retired. He retired after 30 years of teaching calculus. He moved up here to Randolph County with me. He would occasionally buy a bottle, and when he bought the bottle, he would drink it. Okay? Does that make him an alcoholic? Not necessarily. But he was an alcoholic. And untreated alcoholism is as deadly as active alcoholism. I just want you to know that. And I believe he was dying from untreated alcoholism because within 5 years of his retirement, last November, I came up to Georgia and I found him dead. Been dead 3 days. Okay? Now this case, the one they're talking about, contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remain sober, page 33, for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. But here's a man who at 55 years found that just where he had left off at 30, he was back there again. And this is what it is. We have seen the truth, that it's Bill writing on behalf of the first 100, we have seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are in short time as bad as ever. If we are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservations of any kind nor any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol. I was told that if I have a reservation, I'm going someplace. So if I have a reservation in my mind about whether or not I can pick up a drink, I'm going to pick up a drink. All right? That's step one right there. If we're planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind or any lurking notion that someday we'll be immune to alcohol. Cool. Ashley's here. Young people may be encouraged by this man's experience to think that they can stop, as he did, on their own willpower. We doubt if many of them can do it, because none will really want to stop, and hardly one of them, because of the peculiar mental twist already acquired, will find that he or she can win out. Several of our crowd, men of 30 or less, had been drinking only a few years, but they found themselves as helpless as those who had been drinking 20 years. So it doesn't matter how long you've been drinking. What matters is what alcohol is doing to you when you're drinking it. To be gravely affected, one does not necessarily have to drink a long time nor take the quantity some of us have. I had to drink a long time. I didn't have to. I just did. Because I didn't know about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is particularly true of women. And Bill is not picking on women. This is experience. Potential female alcoholics often turn into the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few years. Certain drinkers who would be greatly insulted if called alcoholics are astonished at their inability to stop. And if you remember on the second paragraph on page 30, more about alcoholism, we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost self that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. All right? We who are familiar with the symptoms see large number of potential alcoholics among young people everywhere, but try and get them to see it. And then there's that little snowflake asterisk, and what we do, we go down to the bottom, and it says true when this book was first published. But in 2004, U.S. and Canada membership survey showed about 1/12 of AAs were 30 or under. Now, that's 2004. This is 2013. And where I come from, there are a bunch of people getting sober at 19 and 20. They're not even legally able to drink, and they're already in sobriety. And I think that's fantastic. As we look back, we feel we had gone on drinking many years beyond the point where we could quit on our own willpower. There's that word willpower again. If anyone questions whether he has entered this dangerous area, let him try leaving liquor alone for 1 year. If he's a real alcoholic and very far advanced, there is scant chance of success. There is absolutely no chance of success with me. In the early days of our drinking, we occasionally remained sober for a year or more. That was not my case. Becoming serious drinkers again later. Though you may be able to stop for a considerable period, you may yet be a potential alcoholic. We think few to whom this book will appeal can stay dry anything like a year. Okay, so what he's saying is, that this book is going to appeal to those people of my variety that want to stop and don't know how to stop. And there's no way I should have ever stopped for a week, a month, a day. When I first came in here, I couldn't stop for 28 days. Some will be drunk the day after making their resolution, most of them within a few weeks. That's over and over again. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. Altogether. We are assuming, those people who wrote this book, this is Bill writing right now, we are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. And above stop, I've got the word quit. Same thing. And if you don't have the desire to stop, then what's the point of being here? You know, what's the point? Whether such a person can quit on a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he's already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever. And I had that when I came in here. I wanted to cease forever, but I didn't want to do what y'all were doing. I didn't want to study the program. I didn't want to implement the program. I didn't want to do certain steps. And I continued to get drunk for 3.5 years, over and over and over. Yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. The utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. This utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. How then shall we help our readers, me, determine to their own satisfaction whether they're one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, not for me, but for some. But we think we can render an even greater service to the alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity, so we shall describe some of the mental states, that's insanity, the mental states that precede the relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem. The problem isn't stopping drinking. The problem is, how do I stay sober once I stop drinking? What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree and brought him to the point of bankruptcy or divorce are mystified when he walks directly into the saloon. Why does he do it? What is he thinking? Well, if we remember Dr. Silkworth, we've got an obsession of the mind. And once we start drinking, we develop a phenomenon of craving, an allergy of the body. So what is he thinking? He's not thinking. He's not thinking at all. He just walks into a saloon and starts all over. For me, it was everything's going good, everything's going bad. I'm on the way home from a meeting. I stop and pick up a bottle for no reason whatsoever. No reason whatsoever. And here's number two. And it's going to say, our first example is a friend. We shall call him Jim. They knew I was coming. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable World War record. He was a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He's an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see. Now, all the way up to there, that's me. They're explaining me. I'm a great guy. I'm a nice guy. I'm a normal guy. Everybody likes me. Except for a nervous disposition. Now, I'm a little bit nervous. They call it the jitters. And it's different from the DTs. It's the jitters that only ease and comfort can come from a few drinks. Drinks we see others take with impunity. All right. He did no drink until he was 35. The guy went until he was 35 until he started drinking. Amazing. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us, with AA. We told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answers we had found. He made a beginning. His family was reestablished. He began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. All went well for a time, and here's the big thing. But he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk a half dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him. Okay? Every time he relapsed, AA was there for him. So, I have been guilty of this, and I try not to do it anymore. When I see people coming in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out, I used to think, you know, there's just no hope for that person. There's just no hope for that person. And that's not what they were doing back in 1939. They were not giving up hope on anybody. No matter how many times you relapsed, if you were alive and you came back, they were willing to work with you. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half the time. He agreed he was a real alcoholic and in serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, and here's a real good reason to quit, moreover, he would lose his family for whom he had deep affection. Now, I always say I never lost anything. I gave it all away. You know, because if I lost something, I've got a pickup truck, I'll go find it, and I'll get it back. But I gave everything I had away, including my son. Top of page 36. Yet he got drunk again. He knew he was going to lose everything, and yet he got drunk again. Sounds like Bill, doesn't he? We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story. I came to work on a Tuesday morning. I remember I felt irritated. Now, I've got the word resentment next to irritated. I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Then I decided to drive in the country and see one of my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I'd get a sandwich. I also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I'd been going to it for years. Well, he'd been going to it for years to drink, but now he's just going to stop in and get a sandwich, right? Okay. I'd eat there many times during the months. I was sober. I sat down at a table, ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk, still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. All right, you remember squiggly lines? Italics? Very important. Suddenly the thought crossed my mind, all action is born in thought. Okay, always remember that. That every action is born in thought. You think about something before you do it. So before you take a drink, you think about it. Crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it could hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured that I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. The experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. Okay, and what's this guy doing? Is that a definition of insanity right there? He knows he's going to lose his wife and family, and he loves them a lot. He's got a resentment against his boss because he used to own the place. He stops in a place that he stopped in hundreds of times before to eat. He had no intention of taking a drink, but he had nothing to stop him from pouring that whiskey in that milk. He had no spirituality and no program for an active alcoholic. And I gotta tell you this. I heard about HALT all the time in my AA group. I can't find it in my AA book. It wasn't until I came to an NA meeting in this room on a night that I wasn't planning on coming here, and they read out of the NA book, Hungry, Angry, Lonely, Tired. So apparently, that's where HALT came from. Who knew? I didn't until I moved up here. But let me ask you something. Did you ever drink when you were hungry? Did you ever drink when you were full? You ever drink when you were angry? Ever drink when you were happy? Ever drink when you were lonely? Ever drink in a crowd? Ever drink when you were tired? Ever drink when you had full of energy? I drank on all of those. So HALT just doesn't get it for me, you know? It doesn't get it for me. So it says, thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. Here is the threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of the intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him. Now I'm going to jump back, and I'm going to jump back to page 6 in Bill's story. And right there it says, the remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable in that paragraph. And at the end of that paragraph, it says, should I kill myself? No, not now. Then a mental fog settled down, insanity. Gin would fix that, so two bottles in oblivion. So there he is, right there, saying that the mental and physical suffering with drinking always caused him. And here it is. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea, insanity, that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. And there it says it. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability, and I am going to do this. I am going to skip words that I can't pronounce because I get tongue-tied up here and I don't like that. Of the ability to think straight, be called anything else but insanity. You may think this is an extreme case. To us, it's not far-fetched. For this kind of thinking has been characterized of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon, the obsession, that parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day we would ask ourselves in all earnestness and sincerity how, and I got why, it could have happened. In some circumstances, we've gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified by nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. Just went out to get drunk. But even in this type of beginning, we are obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient in the light of what always happened. Now, if I always know that when I drink, something bad is going to happen, why am I going to drink? Right? Because I have an obsessive mind. We now see that when we began to drink deliberately instead of casually, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences might be. Did I pray? No. Did I call anybody? No. I just went out and get drunk. Got a guy we buried a couple years ago, 32 years old. 32 years old. He was in the program for about 9 months. He called his sponsor on a Friday afternoon and said, I'm going to go out and get drunk tonight, and then I'll come back in tomorrow and pick up a white chip and we'll get this thing going. And he went out and got a bottle of vodka and some Xanax, I guess, and his dad found him sitting at his desk, and he died in his own vomit. 32 years old, two beautiful children, a beautiful wife, a great job, all the money in the world, and yet he had no effective defense. Alright, now this is one that I thought was kind of weird. Until I put alcohol instead of what this guy's doing. Our behavior is absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as that of an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. He gets a thrill out of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles. He enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings. Up to this point, you'd label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. Luck then deserts him and he is slightly injured several times in succession. You would expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out. Now, just put alcohol in front of jaywalking. Presently, he is hit again, and this time he has a fractured skull. All right, now it's getting worse. First he, gets a couple of scrapes. Not going to do it anymore. Now he's got a fractured skull. Within a week of leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car breaks his arm. Has anybody ever been to San Francisco or up to Philadelphia? Anywhere where there's trolley cars? Okay. They do not move that fast. They really don't. You have to want to get hit by a trolley car. They're just not that fast moving. So he breaks his arm. He tells you he decided to stop jaywalking for good. But in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. I've decided to stop drinking for good, and in a couple weeks, I run into a car, and I hurt somebody, right? And I break both legs. On through the years, his conduct continues, years, accompanied by his continual promise to be careful or to keep off the streets altogether. If he just wasn't on the street, he wouldn't get hit by a car, right? Just stay out of the street. Stay on the sidewalk. You can't do it. It's too much of a thrill. Finally, he can no longer work. His wife gets a divorce. He's held up to ridicule. He tries every known means to get the jaywalking idea out of his head. Every known means to get the alcohol out of his head. He shuts himself up in an asylum, hoping to mend his ways. But the day he comes out, he races in front of a fire engine, which breaks his back. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? Yeah? He would. Now it goes on, you may think our illustration is too ridiculous. And I did think that. I thought that when I was first reading the book, I thought, how crazy is that? And then when I was reading the book with a glass of whiskey in my hand, I thought, how crazy is this guy? You know, I have a big book that I don't show anybody because the cover of it has so many round rings on it, it's hard for me to explain what those rings are. It was a hell of a coaster for about a year and a half. Hell of a coaster. And if you've ever heard that AA will screw up your drinking, a little girl just spoke in Orlando last night. I was there last weekend. She picked up 25 years. First person I met when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for my first meeting in October of 1998. And I didn't get sober until 2002. And she sat next to me, and the first, I was bawling my eyes out. I didn't know what was going on. And she said, it's going to be all right. That's all she said. Now, the second day I went in there, I was bawling my eyes out, and she sat next to me again. And she goes, AA is going to screw up your drinking. And I thought to myself, what an intelligent blonde you are. You go to AA, you quit drinking, AA screws up your drinking. I didn't hear what she was meaning. So every time I went out drinking, even with a fierce determination that I'm going to drink and I'm going to enjoy it, I would put ice in a glass, I'd pour the whiskey over it, and there Julie was in my ice cubes. There the old man Leo that told me to drink arsenic was there. There was Ashley. There was Kat. There was all these people from my group in my glass. They screwed up my drinking. I could no longer drink and not think, I'm killing myself. All right. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? We have been through the ringer. Have to admit, if we substitute alcoholism for jaywalking, which I tried to get you to do just a second, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects, where alcohol had been involved, we had been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? Some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply. We admit we have some of these symptoms, but we've not gone to the extreme you fellows did, nor are we likely to, for we understand ourselves so well. Self-knowledge. We understand ourselves so well after what you told us that such things cannot happen again. We have not lost everything in life through drinking, and we certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information. Appreciate your help. But I'm not one of you, right? And then I'm drunk. And that may be true of certain non-alcoholic people who through drinking foolishly and heavily at the present time are able to stop or moderate because their brains and bodies have not been damaged as ours were. They keep telling me that I've got problems, and they're right. But the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. Will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is a point we wish to emphasize and re-emphasize to smash home upon our alcoholic readers as it has been revealed to us out of bitter experience. Okay, now we're going to take the fourth one. Let's take another illustration. Now, there's a guy who does these things, been doing them for 20 years. His name's California Rob M. And he does it with another guy. Right now, they're doing one for about 150 people down at the Winter Park Group. And his name is Vic. And both of them, 25 plus years sobriety. Vic does a tremendous job with traditions. He hosts a tradition workshop every year at a boathouse. I've been privileged to do some of those with him. I've been privileged to be with California Rob and do some of this with him. And Vic's an accountant. And so Vic usually does this part of the reading and explains it. Because this really, you know, I could take Fred out and put Vic in there because I know him pretty well. But Fred is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He has a fine home, happily married, the father of promising children of college age. He has so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everyone. Now they're talking about me again. If ever there was a successful businessman, it is Fred. Now, all that time I was drinking, I was a success. Got up every morning, went to my real estate company, and made good money. How can I be an alcoholic? Because every night on the way home, I would stop and pick up Schlitz malt liquor until I got home, and I'd start drinking whiskey. And I couldn't stop when the day came. I'd cross that line. If ever there was a successful businessman, it is Fred. To all appearances, he is a stable, well-balanced individual. Yet he is an alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital when he'd gone to recover from a bad case of the jitters. Again, the jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves. Boy, do we have excuses. The doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so in spite of his character and standing. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem, which is where we're going. We're going for a spiritual remedy. We told him what we knew about alcoholism. He was interested and conceded that he had some of the symptoms, but he was a long way from admitting that he could do nothing about it himself. Self-will, self-knowledge. He was positive that this humiliating experience, plus the knowledge he had acquired, would keep him sober the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. We heard no more from Fred for a while. One day we were told that he was back in the hospital. This time he was quite shaky. He wasn't jittery, he was shaky. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us. The story he told us is most instructive, for here was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all other concerns, yet was flat on his back nevertheless. And let him tell you about it. Fred says, I was much impressed with you fellows, what you fellows said about alcoholism, and I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink. But I was confident it could not happen to me after what I had learned. Self-knowledge. I reasoned that I was not so far advanced as most of you fellows, that I had been unusually successful in licking my other personal problems, and that I would therefore be successful where you men failed. I felt I have every right to be self-confident, that it would only be a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard. Exercising my willpower. In this frame of mind, I went about my business, and for a time all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks and began to wonder if I had not been making too hard work of a simple matter. You know, I would get sober for 45 days, I'd get sober for 60 days, 90 days, and then I would think, you know, maybe I overstated this alcohol problem just a little bit too much. Maybe I'll just stop by and have a couple drinks with the guys and be hammered and be drunk. And the next day, buy a bottle to stop my shaking nerves. You know, that's what he's saying right there. He was just, you know, I had no trouble refusing drinks, so maybe I'm really not that bad. One day I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I'd been out of town before during this particular dry spell. Notice how he says dry spell this time instead of sobriety. So there was nothing new about that. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased and knew my partners would be too. Now listen to this. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. The end of a perfect day. I went to my hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold into the dining room, and we're in italics again, the thought came to mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinners. Cocktails. We're just going to have a couple cocktails. That was all. Nothing more. I ordered a cocktail and my meal. Then I ordered another cocktail. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. I'll walk off dinner and I'll walk off the effects of a couple cocktails, right? When I returned to the hotel, it struck me a highball would be fine before going to bed. A highball would be fine. Now, I've already set off the phenomenon of craving with the two cocktails at dinner. Now I'm coming back to the hotel. I think I'll have a highball before I go to bed. So I stepped into the bar and had one. I remember having several more that night and plenty the next morning. I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York and of finding a friendly taxicab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. Now, getting off the plane, he finds him a friendly taxicab driver because he don't want to face his wife. Because he's still drunk. He's not done. Now, this guy's a pretty brilliant guy. I mean, an accountant is a pretty smart person in my mind. Okay? And he, about everything else in his life, he is very normal. But now, the driver escorted me about for several days. I know little of where I went or what I said and did. I mean, how can you drive around for several days with a taxicab driver? How much money does that cost? I'm sure the taxicab driver was thrilled. He was probably drinking with him. Then came the hospital with the unbearable mental and physical suffering. Again, unbearable mental and physical suffering. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesized that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come. If I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come. I would drink again. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reasons for having a drink. And remember, it was the end of a perfect day when he decided to have a cocktail. So he didn't have any problems. He wasn't angry, hungry, lonely, tired. It was a perfect day. And out of nowhere, thought of a drink hit him. Well, just that did happen, and more. For what I had learned about alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from the moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem that had them hopelessly defeated, I knew then. It was a crushing blow. I never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. And then he knew he had that same problem. Now, some people don't like this, but, you know, two members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to see me. They grinned. I hate it when people come to see me and I'm drunk and they're grinning. Or I'm suffering terribly from a hangover and two guys show up and go, "Hey, Jim, how you doing?" I didn't have a concealed weapon permit then. And it's a good thing, too, because I didn't like it. Which he didn't like so much either. And then they asked me if I thought myself alcoholic and if I were really licked this time. I had to concede both propositions, that he was alcoholic and he was really licked. They piled on me heaps of evidence to the effect that an alcoholic mentality such as I had exhibited in Washington was a hopeless condition. They cited cases out of their own experience by the dozens. This process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. When we get calls down in Orlando, there's 129, 130 groups right now. My group has over 500 members. I can't tell you how many thousands of people are down there. We have a hotline that if somebody calls and wants to go to detox, or during the day if there's a meeting and they want to go to a meeting, two alcoholics go pick them up. It's always two alcoholics, never one. The reason being, you always want to have a second person there to be a witness if the guy jumps out of the car while you're driving. Okay? You also want somebody to sit behind the alcoholic so he doesn't decide all of a sudden to grab the steering wheel and kill all three of you because he doesn't really want to go to detox. He just wants to die, but he wants to take somebody with him. That has happened. Yep. And we also have a saying, that you'd never done a real 12-step call until you cleaned up somebody's vomit out of your car. That's true. That's true. I've cleaned up much. It ain't fun. But I've seen people get hope, and I've seen people recover. And that's worth every minute of the time I've ever spent going out on 12-step calls. Then they outline the spiritual answer. All right, step three. We're finally getting somewhere. We're still in step two, but they're talking about step three here. They outline the spiritual answer and program of action at steps four through nine. The program of action in Alcoholics Anonymous is steps four through nine, which 100 of them had followed successfully. Though I had been only a nominal churchman, their proposals were not intellectually hard to swallow. But the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. You think? I'm going to write down all my defects of character, and I'm going to share them with somebody, and then I'm going to be willing to have God remove them, and I'm going to humbly ask Him to take them away, and then I'm going to make a list of people I had harmed, then I'm going to go make amends to them? I would say he was right. That program of action sounds pretty drastic. But I have to do it if I'm going to survive. It meant I'd have to throw out several lifelong conceptions out the window. Throw several lifelong conceptions out the window. And that was not easy. And we talk about this program being a simple program. I've never told anybody it's an easy program. It's much easier to stay sober than to get sober. And it is a simple program. But destroying my ego was one of the hardest things for me. And that's what he's talking about. That was not easy. But the moment I made up my mind to go through with the process, once again, steps four through nine, the process, program of action, I had the curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles, if you got a highlighter, highlight this sentence. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. Now, many times when I first read this book, I added words. Not intentionally. I added words to the first step. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable when I drank. That's not what it said. And I added, would solve all my alcohol problems. That's not what it said. It says spiritual principles will solve all of my problems. But I have to apply them. I have since been brought into a way of living infinitely more satisfying and, I hope, more useful than the life I lived before. My old manner of life was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back to it even if I could. You know, they talk about, you know, science may one day invent a pill that'll let me drink like normal people. And if they do, I don't want the pill. Because what'll happen is, I'll go back to drinking like normal people, and I'll lose all my spiritual contact with God. And I like this life so much better than I like my old life. I really do. Fred's story speaks for itself. We hope it strikes home to thousands like him. He had felt only the first nip of the ringer. Most alcoholics have to be pretty badly mangled before they really commence to solve their problem. And I told you I was going to use both my brothers. The jaywalker, a minute ago, was my little brother. He was the one who continued to drink and drive, lost his license. Drove on a suspended license, lost his license for 15 years. Got it back in 8 years, got a third DUI. Came to talk to me about it, knew I was sober, told him, let's go to AA. He went to a meeting, picked up a white chip, got a big book, and said, this ain't for me. I'm not into this God stuff. I'm not into this religious program. And I said, ain't religion. It's a spiritual way of life. I said, what's going to happen, based on my knowledge and experience in the program, is you not only are going to get another DUI, you're going to hurt somebody. So the next DUI he got, which he did, his fourth one, he didn't hurt anybody. Okay? And somehow or another,
through some money that we loaned him, his attorney was able to get the charges dismissed. You ever hear that? Good attorneys get people off sometimes? So then my little brother gets his fifth DUI. And he gets it sitting next to an Orange County deputy sheriff because his foot slipped off the clutch at a red light and he rammed into the truck in front of him and he's sitting right next to a cop. And he is maxed out. I mean, he is maxed out. When the cop asked him to step out of the car, he fell out of the car, just tumbled out. When he tried to explain the wine bottles in his car, those are all brand new. I just bought them. And the cop looked at him and said, "Do you buy your bottles of wine half full?" He didn't even know. He'd been playing poker at a poker tournament, drank a bunch there, and then was drinking bottles of wine on his way home when he did this. And he didn't even remember that he had a half empty bottle, half full bottle, right there. Fifth felony DUI. All right? So he doesn't drink. He can't drink. They put a bracelet on his ankle that monitors his sweat gland. He gets 5 years in prison if he's caught drinking alcohol for the next 5 years. So he doesn't drink for a year and a half. And 5 years ago this month, I got a call from Orlando, and somebody said, "Your brother's in a coma." And I went down there, and he had 10 tumors from untreated alcoholism. Hadn't had a drink for over a year. And so we went to the probation department after his radiation, got the bracelet cut off, got him off of probation, got him free to do whatever he wanted to do. They gave him 6 months to 2 years based on his tumors. 6 months minimum, 2 years maximum, if he, you know, did right. On the way home, we stopped by a meeting. He could only make it about half of the meeting before he said he's hungry. Some of you heard my story, hear this. And on the way home, we stopped to get something to eat. He wanted a glass of wine. Just, "Jim, don't say anything. I just haven't had a drink in over a year. Just want a glass of wine." It's a bad idea, Donnie, but okay. So on the way home, "I want a bottle of wine. That's just so I can, you know, drink a little bit each night before I go to bed." 30 days later, I get a call. He's in intensive care. I go down there. He dies in my hands. That's the progression of alcoholism. Less than 30 days when he started picking up a drink, he was back right where he was when he got his fifth DUI, and he killed himself. He blew an ulcer out. Alcoholism doesn't go away in my body, and it doesn't go away in most alcoholics either. And right there it says, most alcoholics have to be pretty mangled before they really commence to solve their problem. Many doctors and psychiatrists agree with our conclusion. One of these men, a staff member of a world-renowned hospital, Dr. Silkworth, recently made this statement to some of us. "What you say about the general hopelessness of the average alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As to the two of you men whose stories I have heard, there is no doubt in my mind that you were 100% hopeless apart from divine help." Now, hopeless apart from divine help. Step two. "Had you offered yourself as patients at this hospital, I would not have taken you if I had been able to avoid it. People like you are too heartbreaking. Though not a religious person," he's a medical doctor, "though not a religious person, I have a profound respect for the spiritual approach in such cases as yours. For most cases, there is virtually no other solution." Now, Dr. Silkworth had the mental and the physical, the obsession of the mind, the allergy of the body. Dr. Carl Jung, some years before, had told Roland Hazard in Switzerland that he was hopeless apart from spiritual help, an entire psychic change. And so Dr. Silkworth gave Bill two parts. Dr. Jung brought in the third part, that when you talk about we have a twofold disease, a mental and a physical, we have a threefold disease. We have a spiritual, mental, and physical, and it'll say it in a few minutes, until we get over the spiritual malady, only then will we recover from the mental and the physical. You might want to just highlight this whole last paragraph, because they told you more than once already, and they're saying it again. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. I'm going on 12 years sober. I, at some time, do not have an effective mental defense. My sponsor is going on 29 years. Sometimes he does not have an effective mental defense. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. It has to come from a higher power. All right, before we start chapter 4, we agnostics, we're going to take a 10-minute break. All right?